WFSU-FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting of September 8, 2016. Now, to introduce the program, here's Economic Club of Florida President Dominic Calabro.
Our speaker today is really someone we're very, very proud of and distinguished to have, Marilyn Gwax. Marilyn is the National Public Radio's Senior Business Editor and Vice Chair of the National Press Club's Board of Governors. Pretty big deal. Marilyn graduated from the Ohio State University, she asked me to say, and holds a master's degree from Georgetown University. She studied economics and international relations as the Nieman Fellow at Harvard University in 1995, where she earned fame for calling out Bob Woodward to his face for lending his Watergate-era prestige to the emerging practice of, quote, putting together reconstructed quotes from unnamed sources to create over-dramatized versions of very recent history, end quote. Good girl, good job. We all need these checks and balances. I have my wife and children that do that for me all the time as well. Marilyn, by contrast, is an advocate for the sweat and shoe leather journalism, the old-fashioned way, working hard at it. Her work as a business reporter at the Akron Beacon Journal, the Cox Newspapers, Washington Bureau, and later as columnist for the Atlanta Constitution, was informed by her family's deep roots in Youngstown, Ohio, a city that has long been a bellwether for American business and politics. She was a member of the NPR team that won a Haywood Brown Award in 2009 and the Edward R. Murrow Award in 2011 for reporting on the nation's foreclosure crisis. She has reported from unpronounceable locations in Asia, Africa, Europe, and this week we'll be braving the Zika hot zones in South Beach. Of course, she'll also have some other fun times, we hope, in South Beach as well, in service of the public's right to know. She's here today with a PowerPoint and a crystal ball to speak with us about the economy and how it's likely to shape the outcome on the November 8th election. Please welcome Marilyn Gwax. Marilyn?
All righty.
No pressure.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. As you said, I'm a vice chair of the National Press Club, and we do a format. I don't know if you've ever watched them, but they're exactly like this. So I know it's a challenge to put together a lunch like this, and I really appreciate your joining me. I also wanted to give a special shout out to my cousin, Florence Snyder, for helping invite me here so that I could be with you today. I really appreciate that. And I thought I'd just tell you a little bit more about myself. I'm going to think of this as like a yoga class, an opportunity to stretch our necks. We can turn our heads. I realize I'm here and that's where the PowerPoint is, but maybe you can just kind of turn back and forth. So just about myself, I started at the Akron Beacon Journal. As he said, I was a business writer. Interested in what happened to my hometown of Youngstown. Akron's about an hour away, and I really wanted to know what happened to the steel industry. And that really motivated me and started me thinking about global issues, how it is that, was it really, you know, when I was young, people would be, oh, the Japanese steel. Was it really Japanese steel? Was there something that happened? What caused these problems? So that sort of set me off on this path of trying to understand the economy, and in particularly in a political context. And then I went to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and I studied a lot about aviation. I covered the airlines there and other topics, so that was also very interesting and kind of global in perspective. And then I was asked to go to the Washington Bureau for Cox Newspapers, which owned the Atlanta paper. And Washington is certainly an interesting town, so it's been a good run up there. But when the Bureau closed, I switched over to NPR, but today I do all the jazzy stuff. I Snapchat, I tweet, I do Facebook, but I want you to know that's how I started, phone booths and paper. So I've seen a lot of changes in terms of technology and the industry, so I go back a good way with understanding how technology can change your hometown, can change your office, can change how you work, can change really everything. So what I also want to focus on today is then how did things change in just the last 4 years? We're all paying attention to the 2016 election, and how is it different, at least from an economic point of view particularly, from just 4 years ago? So we can look back on things. I mean, I think any reasonable person would say that the economy is in better shape today than where we were in 2009. That was a very tough time. But the recovery is a complicated matter. So let's just go back and think about some things. It was easy in a way to be a reporter in 2008 because if you'll notice, there is like no other story to tell except down. I mean, the economy just completely fell off of a cliff. This is a Federal Reserve chart about industrial production. And basically, we were chugging along nicely, actually doing really well there, and then so that's a nice time to be a reporter. You only have one story to tell. And then in 2012, that production started turning around, and you know, it's really been a very steady climb back. By 2012, we were definitely not there. We had improved a great deal by 2012. But there was still a lot of anger out there. This is a story from the NPR website at that time. A lot of people on the right sort of participated in an idea of the Tea Party. And there was a lot of anger about things like government borrowing, too much expansion of debt. That motivated a lot of people. But that wasn't all. This is another NPR story that was also about Occupy Wall Street, which was anger on the left about big banks. So it was really a lot of economic focus in 2012. There was a Gallup poll at the time that showed that by far the number one economic issue in 2012 was the economy. Actually, 92% of respondents said that the economy was basically the key issue in 2012. So obviously, we didn't heal that much. There were still awful lot of concerns about that. And you know, at the time, the big topics were still unemployment, the deficit, and the Affordable Care Act was still just beginning to kick in. People were afraid it was going to wipe out a lot of jobs. Immigration, just 4 years ago, was number 8. That's how far down on the list of concerns it was. Just, I mean, 4 years isn't that long ago. I mean, it is to a teenager, but most of us, it doesn't seem so long ago, right? And it was number 8. And the reason people were still so distraught in 2012 is there's unemployment. Yes, it had improved. It really came down a lot. But that number in 2012 was nothing like before the recession. That was still very, very high unemployment. Very painful time 4 years ago. Also, the budget deficit was about 6.7% of GDP. That's very high. Historically, a GDP should be no more than 3% of GDP. Somewhere around there, 3%-ish is considered, you know, maybe not great, but normal. And this was more than twice that in 2012. People were not only worried about things like big picture things like the deficit and jobs, but everybody was not happy with gas prices. They were high then. At this time, 4 years ago, gas was in many parts of the country was still over $4 a gallon. Now, there had been this period where the gas prices really ran up in the summer of 2008. It was way over $4 a gallon averaging. There were lots of places in the country where people were paying $5 for gasoline. Then the recession hit, it plunged, but then it came back, and it was painful still. In 2012. So if you had a job, you were paying a lot to commute. If you didn't have a job, you were facing a high unemployment rate. And if you were just, those things didn't bother you at all, you still had to worry about this idea of the deficit being so high. So 2012 was a pretty tough time still for the US economy. Better than in 08, but tough. So now in 2016, let's think about what's happening with the economy and where we are with this whole discussion. In a lot of ways, we're basically back to normal. I mean, if you look at you know, where we were with, what is this? This is the unemployment rate. If you look over sort of the last 40 years, that was the recession when unemployment got really high in the 1980s. And then things got a lot better in the 90s. This was sort of the Bill Clinton era, which most Americans remember as a good economic time in terms of jobs. There were lots of jobs. Then there was a recession in 2001. Remember, of course, the 9/11 terrorism recession. Unemployment went back up. But then we had the housing boom, and that drove unemployment back down. And then we had that horrible recession. So we had two terrible times of unemployment. But now we're back down to here, which if you kind of go across time over the last 40 years, you know, unemployment is really, really back to even better than normal, really. The unemployment rate has been 4.9% for three straight months now. If you go all the way back to 1948, basically look at the post-World War II era, the average unemployment rate is 5.8. So we're at 4.9. These are really, actually, good times. I mean, technically, this is unusually low unemployment rate right now. The budget deficit is also back to where it's more normal. It's still at, let's see, what percentage? Wait, the budget deficit is, oh, this is a long story. This chart doesn't show things as well as it might. Here it was during the worst of the recession, the budget deficit was like 10% of GDP, and now it's back to a more normal level of about 3% of GDP. So we're kind of back to normal there. Gasoline prices. Remember, we had looked at this chart when it went up to 2012. Gas prices were still high. They're much, much lower now. They're down to about $2.20 a gallon on average, and falling, as a matter of fact. So when you look at 2008, when there was the summer of 2008 and gas was over $4 a gallon, look at 2012, it was nearly $4 a gallon. Now we're at about $2.20. So the way most people experience the economy, what does it cost to go to the grocery store? What does it cost to go to the, drive to work? It's a much, much better time than it was in recent election cycles. The other thing that's really a big plus right now is mortgage rates are like ridiculously cheap. 3.25% for, in that range it's been running for mortgages. And that allows a lot of people who got mortgages back in the bad old days when interest rates were really much, much, much higher, 6.5%, 7% in recent years. And if you remember back to the 1980s, I mean, you may recall double digits, 12%, 13% for 10, I'm trying to say between 10% and 13% mortgage rates. And now it's, like I said, 3%. So everybody who's had a chance to refinance is in a much better situation. So between refis on your mortgages and new home sales, cheap gasoline, these are much, much, much better times. Also, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hovering around 18,500. It's higher than it's ever been. It's at a historic high. Interest rates are low. Inflation is almost non-existent. Consumer confidence is back to pre-recession levels. Home sales, new home sales are back to pre-recession levels. So, given how much things have improved, what are the topics that are really motivating people? Well, now when Pew asks people, what is your number one issue? They're not saying the economy. They're saying keeping us safe from terrorists. I mean, it weighs heavily on your mind when you see things like the shooting in Orlando, when you see what's happened in Paris. I mean, people are worried about terrorism. No one here forgets what happened on 9/11. So with the economy down from being the tippy-top issue to terrorists, that tells you something, too, about the economy. So a lot of the discussion in the media, I mean, if you watch what's happening in this election, it's really been a lot about Donald Trump's temperament and Hillary Clinton's trustworthiness. They don't have super specific plans on job creation, for example. It's an argument about temperament, trustworthiness, personality, fitness, I mean, that's a very different story. Nobody in 2012 was arguing that Mitt Romney was not fit for office. I mean, that was not a question. President Obama's temperament was not a question. These are new issues that have emerged as the economy has receded as a top issue. So then you might say, well, then aren't we living in heaven? Isn't this wonderful? Isn't everything perfect? Well, it's not perfect. There are a lot of reasons why people still feel uneasy. And so a lot of the statistics are greatly improved, but there is a middle class squeeze where a lot of people feel that. There was a Georgetown study done about a year ago that showed that the big job growth happened for people in the top third of incomes. If you were a good income earner, you were doing well. That increased for you. The number of jobs increased, pay increased. And actually, if you were at the bottom, jobs increased for particularly restaurant workers. More people are getting meals to go and the hospitality industry. I mean, in Orlando, they've done huge amounts of hiring. All over the country, there have been a lot of jobs created in restaurants and hospitality and hotels. There's jobs for maids, jobs for busboys, and there are jobs for brain surgeons. But the problem has been that the number of middle income jobs is actually still well below pre-recession levels. So people who are in the middle that are fueling this anger feel pretty squeezed. Their jobs really haven't come back. So when you look at aggregate statistics, it looks a lot better, but when you look in the middle, there's still a lot of pain. And I might add, the people who are still carrying the hangover of pain from the housing bust are those folks in the middle. If you own a beautiful home in the best part of LA, your home price has come back. If you're a factory worker in Cleveland, probably your home price has not come back. You may still be underwater you can't take advantage of those low mortgage rates because your credit is wrecked, your house is still underwater. You haven't seen those new jobs appearing for your skill level. So there is a problem with a wide swath of Americans who are not in that top income group or the bottom income group, but you're in that middle where there still is a great deal of frustration about the economy. Another problem that has hurt a lot is the commodity sector is really in a recession. While I could, you know, if you live in Silicon Valley and you work for, you know, if you're working for the Google, you're in good times. But if you are a person who is working as a in coal mining, drilling, farming, any forms of extraction or commodity work. When I say commodity, those are things that can be sold in bulk, like corn and wheat and oil and gas and things that are, copper. They have just taken a terrible beating. And there's not, commodity prices have improved some, but it's still a very tough time to be in extraction industries. And that's where a lot of good income, blue-collar jobs were located. So those are the jobs that are getting squeezed. And there's the issue of raises. This past year, people have gotten raises. The average wages are increasing. They have come back. But holy cow, 2008, that's a long time to go without a raise, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people lost income in 2008 and have never come back to what their old salaries were. And even if they're getting 2% raises now, does that really help you when you haven't had a raise in, 7, 8, 9 years? It does help you, but it doesn't make up for the hole that you may feel you're in. So it's not imaginary when people, they're still, I can show you all the charts in the world about how the stock market's doing great and salaries are way up in Silicon Valley, but don't tell that to a farmer this year who's worked all year to grow corn and is now getting prices that are well below the cost of producing that corn. So just to look back at that wage issue, just for example, in the second quarter of this year, the median weekly earnings were $824. In 2012, that was $771. But if you put that into the BLS's inflation adjuster, the 2012 would have been $804. So in other words, buying power has only gone up from $804 to $824. So let's see, in the last 4 years, you've been working hard. The stock market has shot up to record levels, but you got 20 extra dollars. Wow, kids, we're going to the pizza parlor. You know, I mean, it's not much of a raise. It's a very small increase compared with the level of gains in the stock market and corporate profits and that sort of thing. So increasing your buying power by less than 2% over 4 years, that doesn't feel like where a lot of people would like to be. So when you think about these concerns, you know, when Gallup and others do ask people about the economy, I don't want to suggest that it isn't a huge issue. Of course it still is, but it's changed. That number one issue is terrorism. And then when you come down from that, what are the economic issues people are concerned about? That's where we get into these issues like income inequality, that business of not getting a raise, trade deals that people feel make it easier to send jobs to other countries or to outsource or to, you know, do whatever that undermines U.S. wages. And people fear that immigrants put downward pressure on wages. So, you know, that extends to people in high-tech industries. I mean, if you're a radiologist and the x-rays can be read in India by somebody at a lower cost than you, it affects you. If you're a software engineer, but there's somebody in India who could do it at a lower cost than you, it's the same thing as call centers or whatever. I mean, there are a lot of people who feel that globalization is not helping them. So those are the issues that have really been driving a lot of the political talk this year, is income inequality, trade deals, and immigration, and building walls, things that would keep out the wage competition that people sincerely worry about. So those are the issues that polls have turned up as the big issues. But if that's what we're talking about, is it really what we should be talking about? And what are we, you know, shouldn't we be paying a little more attention to what are the true issues for the 21st century? Are these really the biggest issues that we need to think about? There's a good chance that we are wasting, you know, our breath. Let's look back just for a moment on some history. That's William McKinley, our 25th president. You know, he was running for president in 1900. And when you think about that, on the one side, there's the 1800s, and there's horses and carriages and, you know, people beating their oxen to plow the fields. On the other side of that is the 20th century, all the things that we came to know, you know, after 1900. So what was he talking about? Did he have, were voters concerned about it? What were the top economic issues of 1900? The number one concern in that cycle was, would the country stay on the gold standard? And the other thing was tariffs, especially on wool. They were very concerned about wool. So you had a whole election cycle facing a new century, and it was worrying about the gold standard and wool. You know, by 1933, we had abandoned the gold standard. That became an issue of the past. And then World War II came along, and synthetic fibers basically replaced wool in much of our clothing. And all of a sudden, the importance of wool tariffs I don't know that any of us have spent much of our time this year talking about wool tariffs. It just didn't matter much anymore. So you know, by 1950, everything that had been such a big deal in 1900 would leave people scratching their heads. It was just over. What really was happening at 1900, what was really important, is this. The most common job for a man in 1900, and believe me, I've looked this up in census data, the most typically held job was farm laborer. The most common job for women was being a domestic servant, being basically just household help, a maid of some sort. By the middle of the century, all of those farm hands basically had left the farm and became factory workers. They were steel workers, auto workers, aerospace workers. Farm hands and the farm population just cleared out. The Okies were kind of a good example of, you know, kind of the Grapes of Wrath story of people leaving farms that were destroyed in the Depression and the Dust Bowl, and they went to California and got really good jobs with Boeing after the war was over. And the domestic servants, they turned into typists, phone operators, office workers of all sorts, assembly line workers. Very few people were domestic servants by 1950. The entire job categories that were the most common things disappeared by the middle part of the century. So, what is it that candidates should be talking about in 2016? I think if you listen to economists and people who are in touch with what's happening in the workplace, what we should be talking about is robots and automation. There are really big changes coming in the workforce. I mean, it's going to make the change from farmhand and maid to factory worker and typist look small. The changes that are coming are going to be so sweeping. I can't tell you how much money and effort and brain power is being poured into driverless vehicles. Right now, in fact, the most recent job data show that the number one job that was shrinking in the second quarter was a forklift operator. I mean, the idea of having a guy that you have to pay a Teamster salary so that he could pick up this pallet and move it over to there, when Amazon is designing its warehouses, believe me, it's going to all be automated. I mean, there's going to be robots lifting those things up, not Teamsters, and as we move forward. So it'll start with things like that. The big buzz this year at like the Iowa State Fair, I think it was, where they had where everybody was looking at is tractors that are made with no seat at all. There's not going to be a guy sitting on a tractor. All the farm work will be done by, think Roomba for your cornfield. I mean, literally, there is between drones and driverless tractors, the way we will get used to having driverless vehicles is we'll take it one chunk at a time. The bus that takes you to your car, shuttles you over to your car at the car rental or the parking thing at the airport, you'll get on that little bus and you won't even notice there's not a driver because that bus is going to hook you right around to the parking deck. You won't notice that the forklift drivers have all disappeared. You won't notice that there are no farmhands sitting on the tractors. You won't notice that who's dusting the crops is just a drone going back and forth. Those things will happen, and you'll get used to riding on buses with no driver. And eventually, the forklift drivers it'll be tractor-trailer drivers on the freeway. And, you know, my mom was an elevator operator when she started her career in the 1950s. She would greet people and open the door on the elevator at McKelvey's department store in downtown Youngstown and greet people, and they'd get on, and then she'd pull that big iron door across. And then she got pregnant with my brother, and it wasn't such a great job anymore. Morning sickness sort of took away her desire to be an elevator operator. But over time, when people first started getting in elevators, they were terrified of driverless elevators. They wanted my mom there. How could you press that button? Are you sure? What if this thing plunges to the basement? They much preferred having my mom stand there. But eventually, we got used to the idea that you could press that button and the elevator's not going to go sideways and you're not going to plunge to the floor. And even elevator operators went away. So the same thing with artificial intelligence is going to happen with things like phone call centers. Tons and tons of people who work in call centers in this country. At first, we were worried that those jobs would go to the Philippines. Those jobs are not going to go in the Philippines in the future. They're going to be done by artificial intelligence that will just talk to you and get better and better at that. So we are going to be losing jobs at a rate that is going to make all of our heads spin. And I'm talking about it's happening now with journalism. I mean, I used to teach as an adjunct to teach young people how to write an earnings story. Those earning stories are all now generated by algorithms. Why would you have a reporter sitting there writing up, you know, earning stories when a robot can do it just as well? And I mean, think about domestic servants. You know, robots have replaced domestic servants for me. I have a robot that washes my dishes. I call it my dishwasher. I have a robot that makes my coffee for me in the morning. I call it my, you know, Mr. Coffee. I have a robot that beats my rugs for me. It's my Hoover. I mean, we all use devices all the time. I drive my car through an automated car wash. There's a car washing robot that has taken the place of the guys who used to wash your car. We use robots every day, all the time, and we are going to use them more and more and more. We don't need domestic servants nearly as much. I mean, I'd still like one. But with the help of a dishwasher and microwaves and all sorts of other labor-saving devices, our need for domestic servants has greatly diminished. Our need for them will diminish even more when our house is a much more a smart house. We won't need repairmen as much because people will know when something's going to break down because you'll get automatic feedback from things. We are looking at an enormous change coming to our society, and I don't know. Now, maybe I've missed something. I mean, maybe I have, but I have not heard a candidate for president mention robots. And I think it's the most important thing that we should be talking about in terms of if you're looking at purely economic issues. Entitlement reform, again, that's something that, have you heard any serious discussions about what we're going to do about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, any of those? I have not heard what I would call serious discussions about those topics. And yet, when I look at the demographic, the coming tremendous wave of people who will be retiring and are doing so right now, the baby boomers retiring, it seems like if you were serious about addressing economic issues, you'd be talking about that. And then just general demographic changes as more and more, you know, we've talked about labor force participation declining. Well, there's still lots of baby boomers in the workforce. They'll be gone soon, you know. So you're going to have a lot of talent leaving the job market, especially around the electric grid. There are a lot of people who have institutional knowledge of how to make electricity work. A lot of people who know a lot about how to do, you know, all sorts of tasks, working at ports, bringing barges in safely. I mean, just like all kind of crazy things that you can think of. Air traffic controllers, all those air traffic controllers who were hired by Ronald Reagan in the 80s are now all aging out of the workforce. There is a tremendous amount of talent that it will be leaving and is leaving the workforce. And are we doing enough to bring in people to cope with this demographic change? So there are really big issues, but you know, when you look back on presidential campaigns, whether it was 1900 or others, I mean, I was thinking about some of the things that from, you know, my earliest pondering about any kind of presidential elections, that was, I was always wondering, why are they making such a big deal out of the Panama Canal? Remember when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, that was like issue number one. If you came up to a young person today and said, do you know that in 1980, a huge issue was the Panama Canal? They'd be like, and really? Like, why was that? What happened with the Panama Canal? You know, that probably in retrospect was not like the huge issue that we thought at the time. There's basically non-existent inflation right now. You know, there was Jerry Ford and the WIN, whip inflation now. I think that was his, was that? Yeah, right, yeah. He mentioned that one. So, you know, a lot of things that obsess us in a given election cycle, when you look back even just a couple years later, it's like, oh, that was really nuts. Why were we talking about that? The enduring issues, I think, are going to be a lot closer to these workplace issues of how do we reshape government spending, how do we reshape our educational system to cope with these changes that are coming to the workforce, and how do we deal with the loss of institutional knowledge while training in people in the new industries. I think that it's up to us as journalists to try to push some of these real issues, but they're complicated, and trying to talk about the role of artificial intelligence does not boil down as easily as build a wall or don't build a wall. I mean, some of those catchphrases are a lot catchier than discussing the ultimate impact of AI on robotics. It's just not catching people's attention. So that those are the points I wanted to make about where the economy is and where the discussion is. And I believe we have, I don't know how much time, but questions that we can talk about things.
Okay, first question.
Member of the Tall family, I'm one of you.
I was listening to Terry Gross the other day.
Yes, good idea.
Young women, Jewish women who had come back from, had immigrated from the Soviet Union, Russia, Soviet Union, I think Russia at the time, 80s. And talking about the issues that Terry Gross was trying to get her to talk about the election. And what she did was she turned a question around to Terry Gross, and I want to turn it and give it to you.
Is that okay.
What she said is what the person she was, Terry Gross was interviewing, was saying, was what's really important is how's the winning candidate going to address the losing constituency? So can you kind of look at that from both directions?
You know,
well,
let me just say that I don't cover politics per se. I do economics, so I don't really want to get into politics per se, but I do think that whoever gets elected needs to find a way to get Congress functioning again. People refer to it as the broken branch. I think we can look at the Congress this year and see, there are 12 appropriations bills that need to be passed every year by the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. Not one has passed. There clearly will not be any real budget this year. I think that whoever is the president, somebody has got to get regular order restored in some way to get the budget functioning again. So that's how they do that is purely political. From an economic standpoint, I think that when you're talking about things that need to be done, like infrastructure, you need long-term planning. And it's very hard for people to plan for bridges, roads, ports, without having, if you can't even get through the next 3 weeks with a budget, it makes it very difficult for states and other entities to plan their futures. So somebody, I don't know how they do it, but somebody needs to do something.
Next question. Next. Reggie, I'll bring you the microphone.
Thank you for your insightful comments. Welcome to Tallahassee.
Thank you.
I was in the Fort Lauderdale Airport last Wednesday, and the first JetBlue flight, which I guess the first flight at all to Cuba in 50 years, had just returned. Coincidentally, our community and our leaders, public and private, are trying to get JetBlue to come here. Mm-hmm. But on the bigger issue, I don't know that anybody really understands what President Obama has done vis-a-vis opening up Cuba any different. In practical terms, what has he done, particularly are there any opportunities for Florida?
I'm not a Cuba expert or a Florida expert, but generally speaking, I think just hearing from businesses, there are a lot of people that are really quite excited about the opportunities to open up, especially the hotel industry sees real opportunities to create a new destination that people are excited about. People who want to go and visit family. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily take business away from, let's say, Orlando, because people come to Orlando for pure fun. But a lot of people go to Havana to see family, to set up business meetings or whatever. And if you're a company that, whether you're Coca-Cola or Delta or, whatever businesses, JetBlue, Marriott, people, those kinds of companies will see that as a whole new market that opens up. But it's a small country and it's a poor country. So, we're not talking about anything that's going to change the GDP. But for specific industries, particularly in consumer goods, there were 14 million people, I think, in Cuba. If you got to where every one of them needs a new smartphone, that's gravy. That's nice for whoever gets to sell those products for people. So I think that there's some particular industries that will benefit a lot. I don't see it as having like a lot of competition with tourist destinations in Florida. I think that it'll create a certain amount of synergy. In fact, people might go to Key West and then use that as a jumping off point to take a cruise over to Havana and come back or something. So I don't see it as a downside for this state. But maybe I'm totally wrong because, again, I am not a Florida expert. Yes, sir.
Yes.
This is an economic question. Why do you think participation rate is so low in the economy today? I think probably.
I've looked at a lot of.
It mimics the middle class.
Right.
And what are your solutions to reviving the economy, and which candidate best deserves?
On the issue of the labor force participation rate, let me just, for any, I know this is the economic club, but still I'll just explain it a little bit more, where, you want to have people in the workforce. You want them looking for work and being active, and that's good for employers to have a big, deep pool of talent to choose from. And what happened in the 1970s, particularly, the labor force participation rate went way up because women came into the workforce. People like my mom, who, when she stopped being an elevator operator, became a full-time mom. And that was pretty common in the 60s and early 70s. But then towards the late 70s, as younger women were coming into the workforce, it really drove that labor force participation rate very high. We were getting, practically 7 out of 10 adults. If you were an adult, you were working. And I might add, in the 1950s, man, it's amazing the high participation rates among men. If you were a man, you worked in the 1950s. I mean, it was practically one for one. Like 92% of all adult males had some kind of job. So to be a man meant you were working. The labor force participation has actually, after peaking when all those women came into the labor force, remember I said late 70s, what else happened in the late 70s? I happen to know to the minute at noon on September 19th, 1977, the Youngstown Sheet and Tube announced that it was shutting down. And I remember at the time saying, so what does that mean? Where will the men work? I was like, how could it shut down? How could you not have a steel mill? Where will everybody go? So we were on the cutting edge in Youngstown of the first big wave of deindustrialization. So from the late 70s through the terrible recession of the early 80s, all through the 80s, factories started shutting down. And all those men that I knew as a child, I never knew a grown man that didn't work. I mean, everybody had to work. You all worked at the steel mill or at the GM plant in Lordstown or something. So as those jobs went away, so did a lot of those men. The labor force participation rate among men has come down dramatically. And a lot of what happens there, a big chunk of who is missing from the labor force, are former factory or industrial workers who, once they lost their jobs, never really came back. So that's happening in very large numbers in West Virginia right now. Men who spent 20, 30 years working in a coal mine, your body might be pretty beaten up. It's been a pretty long time since you were in school. Your economic opportunities as a 50-year-old former coal miner are pretty constrained. So we've lost a lot of men from the workforce as factory workers and extraction workers have lost jobs to automation. And they just drop out. They just don't come back. They just kind of go away. And I saw that among a lot of men in Youngstown. They just sort of drifted off or became part of an informal workforce. That is, I knew guys who power wash decks, and they clear snow in the winter, and they mow lawns in their neighborhood. So they have some income, but nothing like what they were accustomed to when they were working for GM. But another big, I mean, there's been a lot of studies about this. About a third of the reason that the labor force has diminished is because boomers are retiring. A huge number of people, about 10,000 people a day, are leaving the workforce. So, I know working in Washington particularly, I know a lot of people who are in their early 60s who are retiring because they're leaving the federal government. They may have been military, they may have been, FAA, whatever, they NIH. People who have been working for decades for the government are starting to age out. And they sort of could still be in the workforce. I mean, you could be a 60-year-old pilot, but you're retired. So between retirements, men lost as factory workers, and then young people who never enter the workforce. That's a tremendous problem. A lot of kids that are just sort of, they just don't have a step into the workforce. That's a particularly bad problem with some, urban areas particularly. There's a lot of kids who maybe don't even finish high school, and they just drift around and never do really connect with the job market. So we've lost people, we've lost some young people, we've lost a lot of men, and we're losing baby boomers to retirement. So that may be good for Florida for right now. Actually, a lot of former retirees are starting to head to Florida. But for the economy in general, it's that brain drain that I was talking about, where institutional knowledge is being lost, and we're not training and attracting the young people into the job market at the same rate that we did before. So men are much less likely to work than they were in the 50s.
What presidential candidate best favors more employment?
It's too political for me. I'm sorry. I really can't answer that. I just don't do politics. I do statistics.
Marilyn, I have a question for you. You raised a really good point up there, and we're really not talking about entitlement reform. And so, what do you think the challenges are, and maybe some quick suggested areas of solutions for entitlement, pension, and/or Social Security, Medicare reform?
We need a new magic wand that gives us a Congress that is based in reality. some combination of magic and reality have to come together. I think it's a tremendous problem to get people saving enough for retirement. Those are just huge issues, because we really do see that people are retiring with too little home equity, too little savings. I mean, we really do need to somehow or other culturally, I think we are capable of making changes. I mean, you think about the culture of smoking. I'm sure if we were all in this room, 30, 40 years ago, there would be ashtrays on the table and a number of people would be smoking. That's just unthinkable now. I mean, nobody would pull out a cigarette in this room. It's just that doesn't happen anymore. So we can make it different. We can give incentives and create social pressures to take habits that seem so ingrained you can't imagine how they would change, and to make them, they just go away. I mean, was anybody walking in this room saying, "I really want to light up. Where's the ashtray?" You might have been thinking it, but you weren't doing it. So, how did we get to that point where everybody changed? And what we need to do with saving is for every young person to understand that just like you don't light up in this room, you don't spend your whole paycheck. We've got to have the kind of incentives just drummed into us that that really change how we think about saving.
Carol?
Marilyn, is it important, in your opinion, that we take steps? Is it important that we take steps to close the income gap in this country? And if so, what steps do you think would be most effective?
The income gap is a very significant problem. I mean, as we went over those statistics, I mean, it is just statistically provable that people have not had good raises, that some people have very disproportionately benefited. The stock market has tripled since 2000, since the worst of the recession, since March of 2009. So if the stock market can triple, but workers' wages are up 2%, maybe, That's a pretty big disparity, and that's going to lead to a lot of unrest. But as robots and automation and artificial intelligence take away more and more jobs, we really, if anything, will have greater downward pressure on wages if we don't do what works, and what works is upgrading people's skills. I mean, if you really do make workers better educated, better trained. For example, yesterday, the Labor Department came out with its monthly JOLTS report. That's the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. What the Jobs Openings does is, just like we have a monthly report on who's unemployed, the Labor Department also adds up numbers of open jobs, how many jobs are open. Yesterday they said there was 5.9 million jobs going begging right now. That's a historically high number. We have never had 5.9 million job openings. That's, I mean, as a matter of fact, in manufacturing, there are 37,000 open jobs right now in manufacturing that are going begging. It's the highest number in 15 years of factories saying, please, somebody take this job. So if I've just said that people have need work and men are dropping out, how could it be that there's almost 6 million open jobs and 37,000 factory jobs going begging? The problem is people don't have the right skills. What people want in a factory is somebody who can, you know, in steel mills, they want somebody who has at least 2 years of training as a metallurgist in a community college. They want somebody who has, software work that they can control the machines, computer-controlled machining, you know, CNC machining, computer and numerically controlled machines. They don't want a guy to push, a wheelbarrow. This is like one of my favorite stories about one of our uncles. Lawrence and I have a mutual uncle, John, who used to work in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube. And one time I was talking to him, and we were talking about how the mills closed, and he said, oh, I always knew they were going to close. They were obsolete. I mean, it's like, Uncle John, you worked in the mill before the war. You're talking about the 1930s. How could the mill have been obsolete in the 1930s? And he said, oh, you know, they had me pushing a wheelbarrow with, like, junk in it, scrap metal and stuff. And he said, and it was a cobblestone floor. They wouldn't even bother to pave it. So if you push a wheelbarrow over cobblestone, you know, your arms wear out pretty quickly. So they had to have a ton of workers to push the wheelbarrow, because they just wouldn't bother to pave it to make it so that one guy could make a bunch of trips. They would rather, you know, there were always more cheap laborers that they could just bring in and make you push that wheelbarrow across the cobblestones. And he said, you know, at the time in the 1930s, that mill actually had started in the 1890s. J.P. Morgan, you know, and U.S. Steel and all that stuff was, those mills were actually 40 years old before World War II. They were actually using 1890s technology before World War II. So, you know, I mean, I never forgot that oh my God, he could see the mills were becoming obsolete because of lack of reinvestment, even before the war. And what saved the mills, of course, was that, you know, of course, Japan and Germany's steel mills were rubble by the end of the war. Everything had been destroyed, as well it should have been. In the 1950s, when there was so much use of steel and all the people coming home from the war and needed cars and refrigerators and, you know, all the appliances that were really, plastics weren't big yet, everything was steel. So the U.S. steel industry, even if it was obsolete, it had customers. And it wasn't, they kept sort of, you know, being ghost ships for another 20 years, and finally it all fell apart in the 1970s. So they kind of had that extra lease on life in the 50s and 60s because of the elimination of competition. So, you know, we can't count on a World War II-like event to prop us up again. We need to be investing in businesses so that we don't have cobblestone with guys, you know, bouncing along. We need modern factories. We need automation. We need artificial intelligence. We need to outcompete the rest of the world. And, you know, that's really where the conversation should be. I think that if we look at this political season, we're not hearing a lot of emphasis on the issues that seem to be actually the important ones.
Last question.
Good afternoon. Great story, by the way, crystallized everything. I have two-part question. Part one is, as you were laying out the economic threats, talk about demographics. Would the low income and the high unemployment of minorities be a part of that economic threat to the U.S. economy? So that's part one. And then part two is, you talked about the issues being complicated. So I mean, you guys know what you seem to have a great handle of what the issues are. How does the press go about taking complicated issues and figuring out how to turn into bite-sized information that people, the way that politicians master?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the issue of different ethnic and income groups being brought along, I do think that, I mean, that's pretty important to the United States. I mean, it is our future as a country. If people don't feel invested in being Americans, if they don't feel like we're all having a shot at getting ahead, that people actually do have opportunities. We've never demanded equality of outcomes in this country, but we have hoped for equality of opportunities. And to see that there are entire segments of young men who are not entering the workforce because they're just not feeling like they'll have a shot is very destabilizing. Any civilization you look at anywhere in the world, the world's a better place when young men have jobs and wives and homes to go home to. I don't care what culture you're looking at. I don't care what era you're looking at. Throughout human history, it is better for young men to have jobs and self-respect and income and preferably a home to come home to with people who love them in it. And I think that no matter what you, whether you're looking at any city in America or any place in Appalachia, any place, anywhere, it's a better country when people feel it, a sense of opportunity and optimism. Now what was the second part?
The second part was you said that you laid out the issues, but then said they're complicated.
What's the role of the press when things are complicated?
How do you figure out how to make it complicated?
You mean I couldn't put this all into a tweet? That's 140 characters, mister. I got room to spare on that one. I do think that it's very hard for the press right now because there are so many distractions that digging into issues in a deep way can be very tough when you have such a fractured audience. If something was on the front page of your local newspaper, kind of everybody in town sort of knew it. I mean, you know, even if it was just because you were you might not have even bought the newspaper, but you might stop by the donut shop and while you were there, somebody's paper was on the counter and you had some sense of what was happening in your community. Now, the problem is we have to split our work into so many different channels, so many different ways to reach people that you have to be talking. I mean, certainly we at NPR very much interact with our audience on Facebook, through Twitter, through really literally every format that you could have, from Snapchat, don't ask, you don't know what it is, neither do I, but still I do things on it. But there are just so many different ways to reach an audience. So on the one hand, it burns off a lot of your energy to try to figure out the 50 different ways that you have to repackage a story to get to the 50 different audiences. And I think that does present us with a very difficult challenge for how do we get this done, you know, when there's so many different audiences and so many different formats. But, you know, I think that NPR is kind of a model of how to do it. I mean, we have radio, we have the local, our local member stations, our national audience, we have our digital audience. We reach people in a lot of different ways. But it's a struggle, and therefore we incredibly appreciate the support of people who support public media. Thank you. I think it's a tough job for journalism to make these issues understandable and get them into people's heads without being distracted by the daily crazy story. Thank you.
Thank you. Marilyn, thank you for your very insightful and thoughtful presentation.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting of September 8, 2016. This program was recorded at the FSU Alumni Center in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another Economic Club of Florida luncheon meeting on WFSU-FM.